So welcome. This is Wednesday, September 23rd, 2009. And does anyone have a comment about meditation or question, either tonight's or in general? Please.
I have a question about last week. You were talking about the phrase love at will.
Yeah.
And, I must have been really out of it, but I'm wondering if you can recap that. That's not sinking in. I'm not understanding that.
Yeah, sure. It's incredibly central. I'll do it a little bit as a story. So there was a time in my life where I was in a relationship, and the person I was in a relationship with was doing some stuff that was sort of mind-blowing and aggravating. You know, one of those combos, like. And I sort of had a choice at that point to part ways or to do something different. And I began to experiment with what I called loving in the face of provocation, or loving at will. And what I meant by that was not, and what enabled me to do that, which I think is a really important precondition, is that I didn't let myself get abused or harmed. Okay, so I maintained my own sort of center, and I had some clarity about what was happening, and I continued to love the person. In fact, I focused on loving the person even more. And it was a very peculiar experience. I thought of it like love push-ups, you know, push-ups in the heart. And nonetheless, it was one of the more valuable things I've ever tried to do in my life. And that was my introduction to, I think, what I would call loving at will. And what I mean by that is that there are certain experiences we have in life that we think to ourselves are fairly under our control. We can do them. In other words, we can get motivated. People say that, get motivated. Well, they wouldn't say it if it wasn't fairly common to get motivated. Or they'd say get interested. We can get interested in things. But get loving, that's like, huh? Nonetheless, actually, that state of being, which is love, is a mental state like any other. It arises due to causes and conditions. And we can do things to encourage it, just like we can do things to discourage it. If we decided here right now, okay, pick somebody in your life and kind of work up a real angry case against that person, we could stir up the causes and conditions in our mind that would do that. Alternately, if we said, okay, pick somebody in your life, even someone who's, you know, sort of pretty neutral to you, conjure up in your mind and start activating the feelings of goodwill for that person, even love for that person. You could probably do that, right? That's loving at will. So with practice, one becomes, I think, increasingly able to love in the face of provocation, even increasingly love when truly you've been really wronged. And even, like in my situation, I hadn't really been wronged. But there are cases of people who continue to love even when they've been terribly wronged. I mean, obviously the preeminent example in the West is Jesus on the cross. And there are a lot of other examples where one can step out of that frame into other examples. I've told a story where the Dalai Lama was interviewing a monk who'd been imprisoned in Tibet by the Chinese jailers for 2 decades or so, and treated terribly, starved, beaten, and all the rest, and asked him if he ever feared for his life. And the monk responded, "Well, yes, I did fear for my life once, when I thought I might be losing my loving kindness for my jailers." That's how, I mean, he defined losing his life. So that's loving at will in the extreme. And I figure if they can do it at the extreme, we can do a fair amount of that ourselves in the daily provocations of marriage, family, work, traffic, and all the rest. So that's what I meant. And it's all about whatever's the gradient. You know, so much of life is about the next step. Whatever is the next step, you know. I've had the experience rock climbing so many times with people who are kind of frozen in this position. But if they would just take the next step they already have, something else would come in reach. And I think that's the nature of things here as well. We kind of feel our way into what's the next level for me with people in general or this person in particular in terms of loving at will, and can I move to that place? And then what will help me move to that place? That's actually a really perfect entree to what I hope to talk about tonight and really discuss with you. So, as we did last time, we pulled out and focused on the Loving Kindness Sutta. This is a fairly famous teaching, presumably from the Buddha, or mostly from the Buddha, maybe with some editing along the way. And I invite you to take one of these. You might have one already. If you do, great. If not, fine. And the larger context here is looking at relationships both as a teaching to us so in many ways and as an opportunity to explore what causes us to suffer and what causes us to suffer less. Or put more positively, what causes us to feel joy and love and contentment and energy and enthusiasm and creativity? And what is it that increases those wholesome states of being? Okay? So that's our context here. And that's the context in which we're using these ancient words that have been literally said out loud for 25 centuries. 25 centuries people have been repeating this. It's quite possible that somewhere in the world right now, some nuns or monks somewhere are chanting this, literally right now, in some language. Which is kind of wild to imagine. So I propose to do what we did last time, which is go around, and those, unless you want to skip, which is always perfectly fine, each of us read a line here, and then we'll talk about, I hope to talk about three particular phrases or sections in this teaching. So, is that okay? I'll begin. This is what should be done.
By one who is skilled in goodness.
And who knows the path of peace.
Let them be able and upright.
Straightforward and gentle in speech.
Humble and not conceited.
Contented and easily satisfied.
Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways.
Peaceful and calm and wise and skillful. Not proud and demanding in nature.
Trevor?
Let them not do the slightest thing.
That the wise would later reprove.
Wishing and gladness and safety.
May all beings be at ease.
Whatever living being there may be.
Whether they are weak or strong, living none.
The grief of the mighty, medium, short or small.
The seen and the unseen.
Those living near and far away.
Those born and to be born.
May all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another.
Oh, okay. How about the next person?
Or despise any being in any state.
Let none, through anger or ill will, wish harm upon another.
Even as a mother protects with her
child, her own child.
So with a boundless heart,
should one cherish all living beings.
Radiating kindness over the entire world.
Spreading upward to the skies.
And downwards to the depths. Outwards and unbounded.
Free from hatred and ill will.
Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down.
Free from grudgingness.
One should sustain this recollection.
This is said to be the sublime abiding.
And I'm holding the fixed views.
The pure-hearted world having clarity of vision.
Being free from all sense desires.
Is not born again into this world.
This always makes me happy every time. Guaranteed, you know? Okay, great. So, thank you. The first of the three phrases I wanted to pick out related to that back and forth we had just a moment ago about loving at will. And it's the phrase, it's the second line, by one who is skilled in goodness. Skilled in goodness. And I wanted to just kind of open it up here a little bit and focus on that phrase, skilled in goodness, especially goodness and skilled. So, first off, what do you think is meant here by goodness? Or in your own mind, what is it for you to be good? Or what is goodness for you? Okay. It's interesting. Great. Thank you. So I would never have thought of that. That's what's nice about hearing how people define things. As soon as they say it, you go, yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah, please.
Living mindfully.
That's okay. And how is that a goodness?
Because you are trying to be the best that you can.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Yeah, back there.
Practicing loving kindness.
Mm-hmm. That's a goodness, yeah. So there's a moral tone here, obviously. Mm-hmm. You know, deliberately. It's morally loaded. It's good. It's goodness. Right? Okay.
Having good intentions.
Having good intentions, yeah. Tarane.
From the same way, like pure intentions.
Pure intention, yeah. Yeah. The word sincerity has been ringing bigger and bigger for me, you know. We, in a way, we kind of live in deeply insincere culture. People are really putting on a front a lot, and performing and branding themselves from their careers and stuff like that. And so the notion of sincerity and taking refuge in your own sincerity, even your own good intentions, in other words, even if it doesn't turn out well, you can know in your heart that you were truly were sincere in your efforts. So back there. Someone back here saw a hand? Yeah, back there, great.
Someone who is able to connect with their essence and come from that place.
Now, so, go on.
Which I think is goodness. I mean, it's what we're made of.
Thank you. That was what I was about to inquire further about, you know, the statement there is obviously that our essence is goodness, right? Has goodness in it. Yeah. Thank you. So what then does it mean to be skilled in your own goodness?
I think synonym would be practiced.
To be practiced?
Yeah, being skillful.
Ah.
Means you try, you see how you did. Recorrect your direction of doing it, your method of doing it, try again, get more feedback, and practice.
Yeah, great. So it's interesting to keep focusing on your particular qualities of goodness, both those that are present and also what the next step is, you know, that next step idea, rock climbing, next step. Skilled in your own goodness. Wow, what does that mean? Yeah, Linda.
So I'm thinking of competence and then discerning that competence or lack of it.
Yeah. Right, kind of close to what Harold was saying there, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, Trevor.
Being aware of one's own strengths and embracing that.
Could you give an example, if I may be so personal, a strength of your own that embracing it is a good thing?
I specialize in listening.
That's a strength. I don't want to genderize this too much, but a man who listens, wow. I was actually joking with this couple. I said, you know, I was trying to coach the guy being more empathic. I said, you know, like, for example, you could say, honey, could you tell me more? And we were saying, like, for most women, if their partner would say, honey, can you tell me more, they'd wonder if he'd been kidnapped by aliens and replaced with a clone or something. But anyway, yeah, listening, great. Okay, good stuff. So, others. Yeah, please.
I was thinking about the I think it's the Quakers, the still small voice within. And I guess it's so much of someone talking about essence.
Yeah.
But that what you know to be true, your true voice. And I imagine using that would approximate goodness.
Sure.
Come close to.
Okay, well, can you say a little bit about what you imagine being skillful with that, or increasingly skillful with that, still quiet voice, might be like?
Well, I think I get into trouble when I don't listen to it, when there are layers upon that where my voice is not coming through.
Yeah.
What I have acquired in the way of some knowledge and wisdom is perhaps clouded over by other considerations,
yeah.
Ego, other things that interfere.
Yeah. So getting
so vain and talking with my teenage son.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think when you're not being your true self, it's so obvious to them, maybe it's so obvious to me. It's really obvious.
That's really interesting to me that how I translate that a little is being authentic as a kind of being skilled in goodness. Right? Again, we wouldn't normally think of that. Being skilled in this, it implies a presumption that your true self is good.
Yeah.
But being authentic to your true good self and being brave enough.
And what you know to be, workable. Somehow, yeah. Things are interfering with that.
Yeah.
And what, where it's,
Yeah.
The afterthought is, I'm better than that. I've learned enough to know how to handle the situation, but you don't. And it's getting back to not hearing the still small voice. Getting caught up.
Yeah.
Biting the this is Pema Chodron says, taking the bait.
Right. Yeah, thank you. That's great. That's great. Yeah, Linda.
Well, I'm just realizing going down a bit, it's repeated or reflected again in let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Sort of an example of being skilled in goodness.
Yeah, thanks. Well, let's imagine then love. Or did you want to say something more?
I have a question which may be going on. I'm puzzled by this is what should be done by one who's skilled in goodness. So it suggests that it seems to be that if one is not skilled, one cannot reason.
One cannot what?
One cannot do these things. Would anyone want to be, to attempt to be humble, not conceited, and so forth? This is what should be done by one who's skilled.
Well, if I follow you right, for one, something to kind of understand is that these words were minimally repeated and passed down over at least 3 centuries, maybe 4, before they were ever written down, probably. And along the way, it does seem sometimes when you read suttas that lines are scrambled. Sometimes you'll see that. And then you'll read the footnotes, which try to somehow make this exotic sense out of why it makes sense that way. But actually, maybe the truth is the lines are scrambled. That said. In keeping with the Buddha's call to everyone, wherever you are, if you're down in the foothills or up in the highest peaks, everyone can do this practice. It's a question of degree. We can all become increasingly loving kind, even if we're not fully skilled in goodness. The way I hear this, though, a lot, is that these are primarily directed at people who have gone into homelessness, men and women alike, in this historical time, who are monastics. They were effectively monks and nuns. And a lot of them were very mature in their practice. And so I kind of hear that opening line is almost like an affirmation of what's already the case. You know, to paraphrase it, it would be sort of like, you are skilled in goodness, and you know the path of peace. So, let you be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's presumptive. It's like a presumptive affirmation. I kind of hear that. Yeah. And so if I could, if let's take the kind of goodness that's about, in this larger context here, being loving. I think most of us would think being loving is certainly an example of goodness, being loving. What is it to become, for you, where are you at with becoming more skillful at loving? What's your growing edge? And do you think about becoming skillful with loving? Rather than you're either on or off, you know? They're either lovable or they're not. So it's about them, right? See what I'm saying? They're either lovable or they're not. They're lovable, love is called forth. If they're not lovable, whatever. Right? That's the norm. That's the typical frame. So where are you at with looking at lovingness or being loving as something that's much more internally generated at will? And where are you at with becoming more skillful at being loving personally?
Well, I have a continuum that I look at myself on. So one is, do I feel lovable? Do I feel loved? Do I feel loving? Am I loved?
Mm.
And I just see where I am on that continuum at any moment.
So part of skillfulness is seeing where you are, if I may be so bold. Once you see where you are, what do you do to move yourself up? What do you do to move the slider up? To be that, you know, skillful.
Right. Yeah. The meditation that you led us in about imagining being loved and letting that sink in.
Yeah.
So that for me is the practice on that continuum. And I use that as a resource. Can I conjure up feeling loved,
yeah,
loving,
yeah,
and then it can just open in,
yeah,
being loved.
Yeah.
So I use that meditation to do that.
Okay, great. Great example. So, okay, other people, how do you be more skillful with being loving?
My experience of meditation is that as I meditate, and sometimes when I go on retreats or meditate longer at home or something for a while, and I let go of my thoughts, it feels like my normal state of being is relaxed and my heart is open.
Yeah.
And that's how I understand it.
How do you apply that, at least in some ways, in everyday life in terms of being more skillful?
When I'm around a difficult person, I remember that.
Hmm. Yeah.
And I don't take it personally.
That's great.
But it is, can be aggravating, so I might remove myself or,
yeah,
do something.
Yeah, great. Mm-hmm. So you remember a state of being that's a strong anchor for you for being loving. And second, you work with your mind to not have so much negativity present with someone being problematic, right?
Because it's almost like not only from reading something you wrote, I think, that our mind is like sticking into negative things.
Yeah, Velcro.
And it's really easy when somebody's in that state of mind to match their energy.
Yeah.
So to really pay attention, you know?
Very good. Third thing you're doing is you're really controlling your attention. You're keeping it on what's lovable about the person, or, you know, not merely obnoxious or something. These are really, I'm calling them out deliberately. I hope it's not obnoxious on my part, you know, to name them so clearly, but they're just examples of being skillful, ways to be skillful with being loving. Thank you very much. I'll just name one thing I do, which is I bring to mind someone who represents for me unilateral lovingness. Someone's just unconditionally loving. And I just kind of imagine them and imagine being them in some way, or having their, you know, taking refuge in them or as them or abiding as them in some way. And that just takes you right in, when you feel it kind of in your body, it takes you right into that mode.
An actual living person.
Yeah, or a notion of someone, frankly, who's saintly, saintliness. You know? Not that I am a saint, but just some of those qualities. You know that we. It's great that. Another one for me was one time just before I was going to give a talk, I was stressing about, will they like me? Will I be good? Will I be impressive? I was suffering. And then I read this Joseph Goldstein quote and the Dalai Lama quote, and then I realized that the most selfish thing I could do would be to give up any kind of benefit to self and completely focus on serving people. Because that would make me immediately feel the happiest. And honestly, it was the most likely way to get a positive reaction from them. So I paradoxically realized that the best move was just to kind of give up whatever I was going to get out of it and totally focus on being helpful and beneficial to other people. And it was ironic and funny to me. I started laughing there, because before I went on stage, that being totally generous and focused on selflessness was the kindest thing I could do for Rick Hansen. Do you see what I'm saying? Just like remembering that's another thing that helps me be skillful. It's skillful to remember that for me. Okay. Yeah.
This is kind of maybe off the beaten path a little bit. I really practice being the most loving parent to myself. All the time. Any slapping of a bad boy, I attempt to come back and be as kind as loving to me. And I can see changes in me, the way I treat other people.
Yeah, beautiful. Wonderful way to be skillful. Yeah. Linda.
Another thing that might be skillful and loving, which is I have a new mantra of embracing imperfection. And the more I can do that, the more things ease. Mm. And it is a way of being in loving toward life rather than contention.
Yeah. Great. Did you hear that? You know, embracing imperfection as like a saying or a frame? Yeah. What do you think about this idea? That we can be actually skillful with being loving, and we can cause ourselves to be more loving.
I actually liked your question the best, because I don't think it's easy. I don't think it's an easy process. Or maybe it hasn't been for me. Mm-hmm. I think it was like 1990. I heard a nursing instructor of mine mention about how people get out of, one of the ways people get out of really troubled times. She was talking about a teenager that was abused, and her way would be to cover herself up with leaves to get this, you know, say these leaves are going to protect me. Mm. And it kind of fostered this thought about that with me. I don't even know. People used to think I had some. I didn't have anything happen in my life that was emotionally troubled, but I behaved that way. That way or something. I don't know. Nothing ever happened to me, you know. I don't know. But I did, at that point, I did consider this kind of sensation of safety that I think was missing. You know, I just joined this gym in Petaluma. It's beautiful. You know, they got this really nice sauna and this really great jacuzzi, and I'm all into this. Anyways, the moral of the story is I get in the sauna, there's one other person in there. There's a little sense of anxiety. Now, in the past, because I've been in saunas before, I might never have said anything. It might be like 3 or 4 months ago that I even got the sense of, well, maybe I'll say something nice to this person. Like that the sensations in me first. Maybe coming from sitting in a room like this for 45 minutes meditating, getting that kind of focus in my mind where I could even make that type of decision. A lot of people, for instance, especially in this economy, I get chatty in here, I'm really sorry about that. You know, it's really tough right now. It's not easy to be loving. As a matter of fact, a lot of people are going through a lot of stress to make it very difficult. Crime is on the up, you know, swing. And, you know, so I think it takes a lot of effort to overcome these problems. I said hello to both of these people. One guy, both experiences were really positive and great, but it did take a little courage on my part. I came out with Happy Wednesday to this guy today. I'm like, well, what are you saying? Hello. He's looking miserable. I'm kind of. There. And there was my gift, right?
Right.
It was coming from something I've been working on.
Yeah.
I do groups like this. It's a beautiful night. They're playing a movie down the street. There's tons of, I could be drinking, you know. There's tons of other things to be doing. I'm sitting here trying to work on, you know.
That's great.
So, yeah.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, that's great.
I love it. It does make, it's not a sensation, isn't it? It's a sensation. So we know when we're behaving, or like we can feel it in ourselves. We can tell when we're not, if we're paying a little bit of attention, you know, it's a sensation of love or you're not feeling well, or you're feeling unhappy.
See, I think that first, you did something that was very skillful, which is you did, you know, kind of love foreplay. In the sense that you did a little action. And again, I think that's something that's really useful. We do a little action, and then sometimes the feelings follow. The other thing is that my own two cents is, honestly, I don't think you need to be a saint to be skillful at loving. I think our nature is to be loving. It is our deep essence. We kind of just, you know, we're naturally warm creatures. It's not that hard. The truth is, to me, most of the time, we're chicken and we're lazy. It's no more complicated than that. So if we're not chicken and we're not lazy, how loving can we be? Right? How much can we pride ourselves to you know, thoughtfully stick it out? Obviously, there's some people that it's inappropriate to do that with or silly to do that with. But on the whole, I don't think you need to be, you know, in robes walking around India, right, to do that. That's my two cents, just to challenge it a little bit. Another phrase to play with? Contented and easily satisfied. It's very interesting, isn't it, that our focus often in relationships related to love is, you know, what have you done for me lately? Right? And we tend to focus on our own grievances. You haven't taken care of me. You haven't delivered the goods to me. My little story on myself, you know, before I gave my talk, my focus is on how loud are you going to clap? How many of you are going to stay in the room after lunch, or whatever it was, you know? How many of you are going to give me a five rating, not just four, God help us, no threes or twos. Oh, God, I couldn't stand it. You know, right, that was, it's all about receive, receive, receive. What happens when we drop that, when we're contented and easily satisfied? What happens then in our relationships in terms of love?
My experience has been the few times I can totally turn loose of it. It's like I'm channeling. Mm-hmm. I'm not attached to whether the person hears me or not, but I'm speaking what I believe is my best truth, and it's coming through me, not out of me. I mean, I really, I can feel it.
That's great. Wow, that's proof in the pudding.
It doesn't happen often.
Oh, yeah. Other people. Great. Linda, and then you. Yeah, great. Linda first.
So I have another little continuum of contention, consenting, contentment. And I'm just struggling to get out of the contention realm. But I see where it would go toward contentment if I could do that. And then
satisfaction. Where would it go if you were contented?
Well, I wouldn't have to go anywhere if I was contented.
Yeah, if in your relationships, what would that do to being loving if you were contented and easily satisfied?
That just creates conditions for the other person to feel also loved, contented, and satisfied.
Yeah. Great, thanks. Please.
Yeah,
great.
When you are contented, it's just easier to give love. It just flows, I think, because you're just happy with yourself.
Yeah. Thank you. That's great. Other people? Yeah.
The story that you told about being totally focused on serving others was the best avenue for you. I'm curious about that because, I mean, there's also sort of like skating on the surface versus deeply committing to serving others and the self-protection about
overgiving or overextending or something. I mean, so can you tell me what you meant by that? Totally focused on serving others was best for you, was the best avenue for you in that story?
Well, it's like Marilyn just said, I thought, it really, you know, to me really touched me, that when you're contented, kind of my primary teacher, arguably, certainly in Buddhism, has been Christina Feldman. And she says, contentment is a state where there's no wish for the present moment to be anything other than what it is. All right? So there's no sense of inadequacy in the moment, and there's no sense of craving. Contentment is very close to enlightenment because there's not much craving. There's not much of a condition that creates suffering. By definition, you're not wanting it to be different. You're okay. Okay, so there's no sense of, I want you to like me, I want you to take care of me, whatever, I want you to clap, I want you to give me a five, or I want you to give me a cupcake, or whatever, right? There's just, and then, as Marilyn said, what happens then? There's this natural outflowing of just happy serving. So what struck me about it was that, one, when we drop the desire to get from others, instantly that neutralizes all kinds of anxiety and fear, and also it neutralizes funny little behaviors that usually backfire, to get approval or liking or inclusion from other people, number one. So instantly you're dropping a lot of negatives. Second, again, like Marilyn, you can see she's like face lit up there. It's happy to be loving, isn't it? It's happy to be giving. It's happy to focus on their needs. And then, frankly, it's self-interestedly obvious that when we really focus on other people's needs and are really selflessly, not foolishly, but basically selflessly serving, and to continue to be selflessly serving, we have to find ways to be fed. Right? But it's in the service of others. It keeps the circle going. Otherwise, we run dry. We get depleted. We run on fumes. First book I wrote was about moms running on empty because they were not refilling their cup because they were pouring out so much. Right? So when we do that, though, people usually love it, don't they? In other words, do you have people in your life who are like really generous and wonderful to you? I mean, bring to mind the person that you thought of who really, really loves you. Isn't that a person who pretty much very selflessly is just, and generously is really giving to you? What does that call forth from you? You just love them back. You love it. So, and for me, the irony of it was, here I was in my own little, I had a contracted moment, I'm willing to confess. I've had more than a few. There I was, upset and wanting to get for me, me, me. And then I paradoxically realized that the best possible way to get for me, me, me was to give up getting for me, me, me. That's what I mean. That's just cracked me up. Just cracked me up. And it served me ever since, really, honestly. That's funny. Okay. Well then, anybody else on this notion of what it might be like to... Well, actually, I'll put it out there a little bit. So often in our relationships, I think we step into them in a what Maslow called a deficit condition. If you know Maslow's hierarchy, five levels. First level basically is physical survival needs. We need to get those met. Then once those are met, then we have safety needs. Right? As soon as safety needs are met, we want belonging. When belonging needs are met, we want esteem. Standing, and then when all those are met, then finally we can tip over into self-actualization needs. And he described the first levels there, those first four levels, as D needs. D for deficit needs or deficiency. Something is missing. We're not contented. We're not satisfied. Right? So I think a lot of times we operate in our relationships with a bit of a head of steam. We're in our felt sense of what's missing. What's wrong, what we haven't gotten, what the history is of them not coming through or them letting us down. It's interesting to just deliberately, at will, activate the felt experience of being contented in the relationship and not wishing for it to be any other way than it exactly is. Isn't that wild to imagine doing that? To deliberately activate that when you go home tonight and see your partner or your children, or you walk into your office and you look at the losers you share a cubicle with, I'm just kidding, to look at them and go, I'm okay. I feel completely contented. It's all right. It is what it is, you know? Like, what would that do in terms of how you would operate in that setting? Back there? Yeah.
The only way I can do that is by being in touch with that essence.
Mm.
Because by being in touch with that essence, that is possible. If I'm not in that place, it's very, very hard to, for me, it's very, very hard to come to that kind of effect.
Yeah. To feel that. Yeah, that's true. But I think for me there's a skillfulness here. So it's interesting to think how to be skillful with contentment. Right? Like a meditation that Christina gave me in terms of a frame of concentration practices is to let your mind get really pretty quiet and then start feeling your way into these three aspects of one of the five factors of contemplative absorption. One of the five factors is called joy, sukha, joy. And sukha comes in three major flavors, happiness, contentment, and tranquility. So she would have me do this practice for each one of those, happiness, contentment, and tranquility, to really intensify it deliberately for a few dozen seconds and then let it relax and then re-intensify it again at will. So it's easy to intensify happiness. It's strange to intensify contentment. It's really strange to intensify tranquility. It's almost an oxymoron, you know, a contradiction in terms. But you can do it if you play around with it. And that's the embedded notion in that is you can be more skillful with these positive states of mind. And these are traditional practices that were given to her. She didn't just make them up. See? So imagine becoming more skillful at contentment. One way, of course, is to just access our true essence, you know, our true nature. But another way is to do little things that make you feel contented, like gratitude. Gratitude is a wonderful doorway to contentment, where you just think about something you're happy about, and then a few other things, and feel your way into that feeling, the state of being of contentment. Remember what it feels like, so you can find your way back there again. Right? Contentment, by the way, is really, I'm really getting into contentment. I think it's a doorway to equanimity, which is a profound state in Buddhist practice. And it has within it a lot of rewards. So you want to keep doing it because it's quite heartfelt. You know, it's a fairly intense experience. And it's positive as well. And also, boy, it has in it a lot of sort of aspects of the enlightened mind, because there's not striving in it. There's not craving in it, because you're satisfied. So anyway, what do you think about that? That idea of actually practicing skillfulness with contentment, rather than considering that it either happens or it doesn't based on circumstances. You know, if you happen to be by the beach and, you know, or something, and it's a perfect day and you, whatever, then you can be contented. Well, what about playing with it as a state of mind that you can dial up or dial down at will?
One of the challenges for me, especially at work, is to deal with difficult situations that come up some days repeatedly. And I tend to want to back away from that, but I know I need to take it straight on, and even though it scares me.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I take it straight on, I'll feel a greater sense of contentment. And if it's really tough, I'll just sit in my bed over lunch and pet my dog for 15
minutes. There you go.
So that's it for me, and also just things that I'm not dealing with now. And then it's like something comes over me, and I'm able to kind of talk to myself and maybe form two or whatever, and just see what's going on and not tending to. But anyway, it's the Monday through Friday a lot of times, the struggle that I have to deal with in order to get to that contentment from 9 to 5 Monday to Friday. It's a little easier. It's a lot easier.
Yeah, and Wednesday nights too, probably.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. And then we do those things that help us move more in that direction, like honestly fixing the leaking faucet or maybe getting a different job. I mean, there is a place for improving our circumstances so there's more of a sense of contentment about them. But just the larger notion that we can do things to activate these positive states, that we're not just, they don't just happen happenstance, and we either get lucky or not. Yeah, maybe wrapping up. Did you want to say something, Harold?
Well, just sort of connecting a few dots, and one is Linda's continuum between contention and contentment, and all this, the notion of practicing contentment. And Sylvia's book, Happiness is an Inside Job, where she talks and just says, suffering is the contention of the mind of what is.
Yeah, right. So, which is the opposite of contentment.
Exactly.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. And then we want to move to a wrap tonight. So, yes, Steve.
I was listening to a CD where it was on difficult emotions. And it said that when you're feeling a difficult emotion, try to absorb it and really feel it. And that's the path to enlightenment. You know, whether it's anger or whatever a difficult emotion is. That's kind of, is that contentment? Does that mean content, being able to really experience difficult emotions deeply as a spiritual path?
Okay, so the question is, some advice sometimes is to really go into the difficult emotion. Classically, there are four that are on a spectrum: anger, sadness, fear, and shame. Those are the big four. And it's a very important question, actually. So how about I respond to it, and then let's sit for a minute and go out and be contented, or else. We'll get to cherishing all beings next week. That was one. That was the third section, cherishing all beings. But if you want to do some advanced work on cherishing all beings, it's okay. It really is okay. It's an incredibly important question, isn't it? And it comes up a lot, actually, in Buddhism, and even the collision between Buddhism and Western psychotherapy. You get that a lot. And part of it's the culture. You know, there's a certain, arguably, a passivity in Eastern culture. Maybe there's excessive passivity there and excessive activity in the West. So you get these cultural debates around this exact question. It's a very important, deep question. Then you have the recent neuropsychology findings and research on trauma and difficult emotions that are associated with, you know, either major traumatic experiences or a lot of micro traumas that add up to a macro trauma. What is, right? Big, big question. So my own view is that, first, the answers to that question vary by individuals and by times. And for one person, at one time, they should steer clear of those negative emotions just about as much as they should steer clear of their ex-husband or ex-wife or something. They're just, it's not good, it's not safe, it's not good. Other people really need to open up to these painful feelings and allow them to be there. So that's one. Two, the basic teachings are certainly to be mindful and to open out to what is there and to be mindfully present with what's there. And in the process of being mindfully present with what's there, the larger context of that is that there are a lot of other wholesome factors that are just presumed to be present. But how can I put it? But even though the teachings of mindfulness presume a lot of other wholesome factors being present, they may not be so obviously presumed in the West. And so it's important to really call this out, that when people are being with a difficult feeling, it's in a context of a sangha, a lot of support, and a lot of other positive factors going on in them, including positive emotional factors. So that's very important to understand. That I think about the imagery that if you're trying to build a treehouse, right? Go find a tree that's got a trunk 2 feet thick. Then you build a good treehouse. But don't try to build a treehouse on top of a little sapling. Don't burden it. It's too much. You're asking too much of it. And I often think we ask too much of ourselves sometimes and other people. And we don't have the patience to let the conditions grow, let the foundation grow, till it can really support that thing. And so then, if we are with that, I think it's, I'm going to put this, I personally don't think it's that useful to be awash in an unchanging, intense negative experience for more than a few minutes. I think there's a place for that. Great sorrow, intense anger of certain kinds, remorse, apprehension. But if it's more than a few minutes straight, is a loose statement, hedged the way I've hedged my statements here. One, I'm really afraid that you're just wiring more neurons together. You're just deepening the neural trace of that negative mind state. What's the benefit of that? Is it really releasing? Is it making you more able to love and to be happy? I don't know. So I'm careful about that. I should have added, too, that when we're mindful of it, we're not just to be blown away, but at some point you want to start observing it. What are its qualities? How is it impermanent? How is it changing? What are the conditions that create it? We're bringing insight to bear. We're not just flooded with feeling. I don't get a lot of value in being just flooded with feeling, personally. I may have a bias there. And then in my own personal opinion, it's highly appropriate to help it on its way. And that's the art. You know, when to hold them, when to fold them. In other words, how long do you kind of open out to that feeling? And when do you start saying, okay, I'm shifting into the different, it's not like you receive, you release, you replace. That's three good words in a row. You want to receive the state of being, you want to open up to it, especially if you know your tendency is to inhibit affect and to resist overwhelming emotion. Most people have that, definitely most men have it. So you're guilty until proven innocent in that regard, just like I am too, you know. Given my upbringing, I definitely was inhibited. So I think it's useful to do that. But there's a rhythm to it that's healthy, where you go, you know, it's time to move into the release cycle, all right? And then you do different things to help release it, like relax the body, exhale, you know, because often with the feeling, there are thoughts that are embedded in it that can be challenged, they're inappropriate, they're wrong. That was then, this was now. They're out of proportion to what's really been happening now or something like that, you know. You know, there are different visualizations. There's a whole technology, skillful means about releasing. And then after it's relieved and released some and the storm has passed and there's kind of a clearing, then we want to take in and replace something that's useful, right? Maybe it's simply the sense that I got through that. I can stand those feelings. I'm all right. Or a sense that after that feeling passes, the true nature that remains is awake and benign, I think. Or sometimes there's a lesson. You know, after the emotion passes, we have some hard-won lessons that we messed up in some way and we ought to do something different next time. Or we let someone mistreat us and we're not going to do that again. Or, you know, everyone dies, even the people we love most. So we let these things in. You know, to me, a lot in life, and I'll close on this thought and then let's set. We have learning experiences and we serve ourselves and everyone in the world by maximizing our retention of the lessons. And a lot of times I think we have these hard-won lessons that are present in our own mind and then they slip through like water through a sieve. And we only help ourselves and other people by really helping those lessons stick to our ribs and have a steep learning curve rather than a shallow one. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, and thanks for allowing me to move on, and then let's, and I'm happy to stick around for a few minutes for other people too. Okay? Let's sit for a minute. May our sincere efforts help free ourselves and others from suffering and its causes. Thank you.